Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 103, we'll be looking at some of the science and metrics behind Monocle's Livable Cities Index and hearing what was on the agenda at this week's Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore.
The main aim is to get as many Asian defence leaders in the room as you can and get them all talking. And I think this year the main headline was that the Chinese defence minister was attending for the first time.
That was our Asia defence correspondent Trevor Moss. And I'll be playing you a bit of this from Israel in the culture section. That was Man of Another Woman by Yael Naim. And later in the programme, we'll be asking Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper, about what to expect at this week's Art Basel.
I think for modern and contemporary art, Basel is still the gold standard. There will be a solid core of German galleries, Swiss galleries, the leading American galleries, the leading London galleries, who will always try to get their seat at that fair.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's Sunday, June the 12th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Robert Bound, standing in for Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
Good morning,
Hello.
Gents.
You're right. You look quite good in the big seat.
It's all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Long live the king. What's the other bit of that sentence? I can never remember. The king's away, anyway.
Yes.
The king's on holiday.
The king's in his swimming trunks. Long live the king.
The king's, exactly. But I think actually, as if by magic... He's kind of spying on us. There's a wiretap in the studio. Okay. I think Tyler is actually on the phone from his holidays. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Steve. Hi, Andrew. And
hello.
I'm not in my swimming trunks. I'm in some jaunty beige shorts with sailboats on them, though.
That's near as damn it.
We're in our swimming
trunks. They're not swim trunks.
Well, we're still in our pyjamas. The beige shorts with sailboats on will have to do. Whereabouts are you in these shorts, Tyler?
I'm in Versilia. I'm at a fantastic property. We had it in the magazine... a year and a half ago, it was in our travel top 50, not this Christmas, the Christmas before. It's called Locanda al Colle, and it's just up above, it's beside Pietrasanta, it's near Forte de Marmi. It's 9 rooms. It's really a brilliant little property.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like we're here to talk about our 25 to 11 most livable cities in the world. And it sounds like you're going to be cranking out an urgent email to everybody to lobby for Versilia. How does Versilia rank so far, the days you've been there?
The Versilia region does very well. Andrew, you're not going to like to hear this, but I think that we need a whole new series of metrics. But probably before we get to those, part of them being Prosecco fueled metrics, we should probably talk about... what we did this year to shake things up.
Yeah, so over the years we've got used to the idea that perhaps, you know, some of the kind of more staid cities have been kind of nudging their way too far up the list. And we want to kind of shake it up a bit this year and kind of open it up to some of those cities that just having like kind of a great 24-hour metabolism. So that was one of the key things we looked at in the metrics this year. And also I think we were aware that, you know, lots of cities are kind of suffering a bit through kind of economic adversity. And so also we went out and thought about which cities, even if they were having a tough time, were actually cities that were open for opportunity and that were places where you would want to go and start a business. So I think that kind of opportunity-led factor has also, again, helped some interesting cities come into the kind of the tail end of the listings. Plus, and then some really kind of nitty-gritty things that we changed as well this year. So we've added in, for example, a number of electric charging points for electric cars. And I think we've just kind of tried to make it a bit of a broader kind of set of metrics, not too focused on, you know, and even then we'd never really focus it that much on like health and education, but we've just made sure it's kind of broadened out of that to kind of take in the kind of the lives that we all lead and the kind of lives that we want to lead in our cities.
I thought what was also interesting about it was really, even though they're quite small, subtle changes, but also I think when we sat down to really reshuffle the top 40, you know, cut out those 15 and then arrive at our top 25, even though over the last few years there's been a lot of people who've held with their top positions, it has been a bit of a shake-up this year as well.
Well, yeah, there's going to be some kind of big surprises next week when we kind of reveal the top 10, because I think today we're just going to speak about the bottom 15. But I think even there we've got a couple of new entries. So, for example, Hong Kong nudged its way onto this. And that's not just because we have great old Liv campaigning for Hong Kong out in the Hong Kong Bureau. But again, it's just one of those cities, you know, that we have to recognise, you know, that while there's some things that quite obviously are not right about Hong Kong, there are so many things that are. And for kind of people doing business and for people after kind of that 24 for our metabolism. I think it's kind of an amazing city to kind of be in.
And I guess there's also another thing, which is that our five cities in the back of the magazine, which are cities that kind of wouldn't normally get into the metrics or wouldn't get into the quality of life survey on their metrics alone, but get in because there's something special about them, something of the night about them.
certainly your assignment to Seoul, Rob, for sure.
Well, it was funny because we were talking about it in the office earlier this week, and the expo looks great in the magazine. There's a lot of daylight in it, and I can't remember seeing Seoul in that much daylight. I looked at some of the.
We tried to talk to Poppy and to Rich on the photo and art desk to see if they could somehow darken the pictures down a little bit.
I know. I had to look at a lot of the captions and kind of think I didn't know what you looked like in the daylight.
But any good photographer obviously, you know, work more in the daylight hours when you obviously, you know, work a bit better during the nighttime hours.
Oh, Steve, there you are.
Hello.
You're in studio.
I'm here. I'm just perusing the top 25, or the 11 to 25 anyway. I thought one of the things that was quite interesting was Lisbon rising slightly from 25th to 23rd. But you know, as an example, as one of those cities that, although Portugal is obviously going through, you know, huge problems at the moment, Lisbon as a city still has a certain vitality about it. It's got something about it in a way that perhaps Dublin, for example, might be lacking at the moment.
And let's make it clear, well, Dublin ain't in the list.
Yeah.
One thing that we've talked about as well, and certainly a city like Lisbon, if you had the capital to go there right now, knowing that, you know, inevitably the economy is going to bounce back, what you could get your hands on in terms of either a dilapidated hotel to be able to take over a whole city block and redevelop it, you know, to move your staff to a slightly sunnier city. I'm not suggesting that we're going to move to Lisbon anytime soon, gentlemen. But all of these things strike you that, and I think that's what we were talking about earlier on, Andrew, that it is very much a city of opportunity too.
Yeah, and I think I was also kind of struck this year looking at the list that it's a very kind of pivotal moment, I think, for lots of kind of cities, because it'll be interesting to see how much gets cut from budgets over the next 2 or 3 years. So, for example, the Spanish cities have actually done very well over the last 2 or 3 years because they've been using lots of the money that they've had to kind of kickstart the cities in a way, to use urban adventures in a way to employ people. But as that money begins to dry up, it'll be interesting to see which cities already have spent their money wisely on the kinds of things that change a city forever and kind of add to your quality of life and encourage businesses to settle there, and which cities have kind of just wasted the money on things that actually won't stand the test of time.
I'm wondering if at this point, and I'm nowhere near the control deck, but whether we should listen to our 25 to 11 at this point.
I think they can probably make that happen. You can click your fingers from Vasilia and it will be done.
Wonderful.
Here is our Tom Morris and Jonathan Openshaw, and a bit of jazz flute, I think, announcing the most livable cities from number 25 to number 11.
Seattle leaps onto the list for the first time at 25, thanks to its pristine setting and revived neighbourhoods.
Montreal slips 5 places to 24, suffering from an overburdened transport infrastructure, while Lisbon jumps 2 slots to 23, shrugging off some of its recession blues with its surprisingly fresh retail scene.
At 22, Hamburg faces a funding squeeze that could threaten its cultural riches.
Kyoto moves up 1 place to 21 in recognition of its balance between ancient charm and vibrant modernity.
Slipping 4 places to 20, thanks to its lacklustre approach to contemporary architecture, Vancouver still charms us with its breezy cosmopolitanism and great setting.
Honolulu, at 19, sees its reputation as a crucial US-Asia gateway reinforced as it gears up to host the APEC summit later this year.
Next up is fellow American city Portland, leaping 4 places to 18 because of its can-do vibe.
Hong Kong makes its debut appearance at 17 for its ever-growing business clout and connectivity and hot metabolism.
Fukuoka follows at 16, hot on the heels of Singapore, which has jumped 7 places to 15 due to its winning airport and superb education and medical services.
At 14, sunny Barcelona is pipped by Auckland at 13, which has seen a spate of redevelopment ahead of September's Rugby World Cup.
Paris's upcoming electric vehicle hire scheme and metro expansion plans puts it at number 12.
And finishing off our ranking of 25 through 11 is Stockholm, falling out of the top 10 for the first time amid concerns that its conservative planning regime is stifling innovative architecture. But we still love it. Listen in to our special edition programme on Thursday the 16th of June for the cities that earned the top 10 places.
You heard it here first. I wanted to ask a question from the C section, looking at speaking to my editors at the front of the magazine, when you visit a city and you love it and you do business there and you look forward to going back to it and you find that it is either not in the survey or it is quite far down the survey because it doesn't add up for the metrics, how does that work? Do you feel frustrated that certain places are and aren't in there?
Well, I think I quite like it, actually, just hearing that kind of rundown. You can hear teeth gritted over kind of breakfast around the world. Where's my city?
Yeah.
And what's great is, you know, that every time people say to us, you know, like last year someone said to us, you know, honestly, you've really got to go and look at Chicago. It's an amazing city. You know, it's as good as any kind of Nordic capital. And then she went, you know, yeah, the crime rates come dramatically down, but there were still over 500 murders. And then you look at other cities where there's like two or three murders. And we're really talking about here things that we can identify and talk about. You know, obviously there's a kind of a bit of grit and spice that we kind of is added into the mix as well by us. You know, we're saying it's kind of 70% on the metrics, 30% on really what our editors have found on the road. But, you know, we can prove it in a way. These all stand up for what we believe in and the kinds of things that matter for kind of Monocle readers.
I think there's also a big difference between cities and suburbs and parts of cities. So, you know, for example, in London, you know, you might be able to pick an area like Marylebone and say, it's beautiful, it's great, it's wonderful for business, it's got great shops, it's got green spaces. But London, taken as a whole, also includes Willesden Green. And, you know, you wouldn't say exactly the same things about Willesden Green as you'd say about Marylebone. So I think Willesden Green. it's a long way up the Jubilee line. I don't think you've got that far. But I think that's where some of the bigger cities fall down, is that they might have certain pockets that we all know and love and which are really great to go to. But as a city as a whole, they perhaps don't work out quite so well.
Rob, I wanted to go back to your point about Section C, because I actually feel that there is a complete Section C lobby, which is C for Chicago.
Yeah.
Because, Andrew, when you mentioned it, I don't know how many notes there have been, even in the last 3 or 4 weeks from Chicago, people saying, oh, is the voting closed? You know, could you please, if you have taken a look, can you take another look at Chicago because it's so great? But what's interesting, and Steve, it picks up on your point, everyone forgets about the south side of the city. It's like, okay, well, let's not talk about that. There is a big problem. There are an extraordinary amount of homicides there. But focus on the north shore of the city and look at some of the interesting emerging neighborhoods. And that does not entirely a city make.
No, and I think also that, as Rob was alluding to earlier on, I think that what I like as well, this issue, it really does kind of go off track as well, off piece. In the back of the magazine, when we do this big expo that looks at five cities that would never win on metrics, you know, there you're in a city like Buenos Aires, where, let's be honest, you know, if you were going to have an operation, you'd probably rather have it in Geneva. You know, if you were going to send your kids to a posh school, you'd probably want to do it in Paris rather than Buenos Aires. But you know what? When it comes down to it, people just love Buenos Aires. It kind of ticks the boxes. It makes people feel alive. It looks amazing on page. And I think that that's the good thing about this issue. It always kind of celebrates the quirky, and we're quite aware that there are cities that are just kind of sexier, more dashing in a way that you really, really love, but just unfortunately can't win on that kind of top 25 list.
Yeah, and here in line, my new metrics, Andrew, these are the ones from the Versilia vote anyway.
should we need some sort of Eurovision kind of intro, an intro stab here?
We do. I was going to say they're about. I couldn't even come up with. I wanted, you know, I like a list of 10. I think I could only get about as far as 7 or 8. But I said least amount of time spent in a vehicle has to be one of the best things, which means that you have to be spending a lot of time on a bicycle. And there's nothing better than certainly with a week off to just ride around on a bike, never have to rely on a taxi, and just be able to pull up anywhere. And certainly in this part of Italy, you don't have to really worry about locking your bike up too much. The other one is, I think that you have to have easy access, of course, to a fantastic coffee at a good bar in the morning. And then that means also that same bar has to serve good orange juice. And then you can go back 6 hours later and then you have a good aperitivo. There also has to be, of course, a well-stacked newsstand. And the Italians do this brilliantly. And that has to be accompanied by a good shave. And then I said you need to be certainly immersed in good architecture. And there's been a lot of fantasy home buying this week in around Versilia. I think there was one more, which was, of course, you know, a good beach club as well. And they do that brilliantly in Italy.
What's been your aperitivo of choice?
It's been a Veneto Spritz, Rob.
Nice. Well, I kind of missed out on this. A bit of Aperol.
Yeah, so I think, isn't it three parts Aperol, two parts Prosecco, one part a splash of Pellegrino or something?
Yeah, that's about it. You can, and then I think the measures change depending upon how late it is in the evening.
Can you ask him to hold the Pellegrino?
Hold the Pellegrino. Yes,
you can do that. You can do. You can mix it 3 and 3 if you want to.
Nice. And next week we're having a special edition of the programme where we announce the rest of them and the winner, the surprise winner.
Yes, I think we'll probably be a little bit hungover at that point because it'll be the day after our the big announcement party as well.
It's going to be an amazing show.
Yes, I look forward to seeing you boys then.
Okay.
See you next week, Tyler.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back after this. Last week, the 10th annual Shangri-La Dialogue took place in Singapore, otherwise known as the International Institute of Strategic Studies Asia Security Summit. It's considered the most important gathering of Asia-Pacific's defence ministers and their civilian and military chiefs of staff, and it aims to foster mutual interaction, understanding and trust between countries in the region. Our Asia defence correspondent, Trevor Moss, was also in attendance, and he now joins us on the line from Hong Kong to tell us more. Hi, Trevor.
Hello.
So really, we want a roundup of the Shangri-La Dialogue. It's the International Institute for Strategic Studies Security Summit. I'm glad they've kind of managed to call it something else. What's the overall sort of atmosphere, and what's it aimed to achieve?
Well, I think the main aim is to get as many Asian defence leaders in the room as you can and get them all talking. I think Asia has always lacked multilateral structures, and the Shangri-La Dialogue has filled an important gap in that respect. And I think this year the main headline was that the Chinese defence minister was attending for the first time, and I thought that many people were hoping that this would usher in a new phase of openness on the Chinese part, that obviously people have long sought reassurance from China about their intentions militarily. And the fact that the defence minister came this year was some hope, a signpost that China wanted to be more open about what it was planning. But unfortunately, it didn't really work out that way. The Chinese defence minister gave a speech that was, you know, big, as often happens with Chinese speeches, you know, very big on rhetoric. He talked a lot about peaceful coexistence. But there was perhaps a gap between that rhetoric and what's actually happening on the ground, which is that a lot of China's neighbours are very concerned about China's actions and about what China's real intentions are. And I think some specific concerns, particularly concerns of countries like Vietnam and the Philippines, who are some of China's smaller neighbours, that those concerns weren't really addressed by the defence minister.
I wanted to ask you a specific question about China. Presumably, it's great that the Chinese Defence Secretary turned up, but presumably he was toting pictures of this new Chinese aircraft carrier on his mobile phone. People must have been in two minds about that as well, presumably.
Well, that was another thing. I mean, he didn't mention that at all in his speech, and I think that's probably a bit embarrassing for him now that, you know, he got up on stage and said, you know, China has nothing to hide, and not mentioning anything about China's specific weapons programs, even though people asked him about that from the floor. And then, of course, a couple of days after the Shangri-La Dialogue, his colleague Chen Bingde announces that, yes, China is developing an aircraft carrier. So on the one hand, you have the Chinese defense minister saying, oh, we have nothing to hide. We want to develop in peaceful harmony with you. And then a few days later, this new weapon system is announced. So there is a bit of a disconnect between what the defense minister is saying and what the Chinese military is actually doing.
And what sort of people actually turn up to this? Obviously, the Chinese defence minister turned up for the first time. Is it him and his counterparts, his equals from the rest of the region, I guess, stretching right down to Australia?
Yes, I think most Asian defence ministers have attended this event. India's defence minister didn't attend this time, but has in the past. And I think every Asian country was represented this time, apart from North Korea, even them. The Burmese defence minister attended this time, which was arguably controversial, but Burma has made some political progress lately. So that was another interesting sign that the Burmese minister was invited and turned up.
Trevor, hi, it's Steve here in the studio. I wanted to just ask you about the Americans, because obviously Robert Gates was there and he made a speech saying, oh, don't worry, we're going to stick around in the region. We'll be the sort of... we'll be there to protect you if the Chinese get a bit feisty. Do you think they really can, though? I mean, can the Americans actually afford to stick around in that part of the world?
Well, I think we'll have to see. I mean, certainly the biggest theme of the conference was that not so much that Asian countries were worried about China's military development, but they were more worried about the USA pulling out. And Gates wanted to reassure them on that front. And, you know, he specifically said that the US was thinking about deploying warships to Singapore, and the Singaporeans said they were happy to go along with that. And other Asian countries said that was something they would welcome. So now that the US has said it's going to do that, it's really going to have to put its money where its mouth is, which was the phrase that Gates used, and make sure that happens. Because if that doesn't happen, then people are going to start saying, well, you really can't afford to play this role of Asia's policeman anymore. And that will obviously worry a lot of people that don't want to see China lose that balancing power, which is the US.
Trevor, it's Andrew here as well. I wanted to ask a question, which is, I wondered what the people like Vietnam and the Philippines actually make of the Shangri-La dialogue now. Because what's interesting is, you know, obviously America swamp comes in and kind of dominates the headlines, China does. And even this time, Russia seemed to be kind of barging in and wanting to kind of its voice to be heard about its ambitions within the region. Mm. Does it mean that those countries kind of dominate everything that happens there and the smaller countries actually get kind of swamped?
Well, I don't think it does. I mean, I think it's a great opportunity for those countries. I mean, what you got was the Chinese defense minister saying his rather bland piece about peaceful coexistence. And then right after him, the Vietnamese and the Philippine ministers got their turn on stage, and they, you know, didn't pull any punches. They really wrapped China on the knuckles very publicly in a room full of world defense leaders. And it was a really good stage for them to voice their concerns and to let everyone know how uncomfortable they are. And it's also a shot across the bows of other countries within Southeast Asia who are perhaps more pro-Chinese, for them to know that their Southeast Asian counterparts within ASEAN are very concerned. And I think it's probably the opposite is the case, that countries like the Philippines use these events to really punch above their weight.
Trevor, yeah, I wanted to ask you an additional question about that, about what kind of work actually gets done at these conferences. I guess there's a certain amount of flexing of muscles, and there's people kind of peering over a perceived parapet. But how useful do you think they are for A, the big countries, and B, the smaller ones?
Well, I think someone described it to me as Asia's biggest networking event, and I think that's how a lot of people who attend see it. I mean, it's a sort of bewildering array of people there, and it's the speeches are one thing, but there's an incredible array of bilateral meetings going on. Many of them are high profile. The US defense secretary met his Chinese counterpart, but it's an opportunity for all these countries, either formally or informally, to, you know, to meet their opposite numbers and to, you know, make progress to raise some issues of concern. And I think that's this event's real value, that it's a chance for, in particular, for the ministers of the smaller countries, perhaps, to make personal contact with their opposite numbers in countries that they don't often get the chance to meet.
So there's a general idea of people decorated with lots of medals, meeting people in a way that means they don't have to earn their medals all over again in active combat, I suppose.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, of course, I should have mentioned that there are many senior military officers as well as government ministers at this event. And I think that's one thing that many countries, including the US, has been trying to stress, the improvement of military-to-military relations. Because, of course, government ministers tend to come and go, but senior military officers tend to be around for a little bit longer. So it's, in some ways, it's at least as important that they get to know their counterparts. And this is certainly something that happens at the Shangri-La Dialogue.
Well, we trust you are well protected there at the Shangri-La. Trevor, thanks very much for your time. On the line from Hong Kong, that was Trevor Moss.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where it's time for culture with me, Robert Bound. What do you think about that?
So you're interviewing yourself during this bit?
I've got my sock on my hand, and I'm going to talk to my sock.
Can I just say that
What do you think?
You got rid of Tyler, yeah. And now you don't need us.
No.
It's the Bob Bound show.
At Live Aid.
Yeah.
In the 80s.
Were you there?
Queen, no.
Okay.
Queen did their best performance, didn't they, ever?
They did.
Because their roadie was in charge of the sound system for the whole thing. They needed someone to be in charge of the sound system for the whole thing. So that's why Status Quo opened the whole of Live Aid internationally. And then the second band on were Queen. And, of course, their roadie just basically turned all the amps up to 11. So they basically became the best person. And that's what I'm doing. I pay Sharpie in biscuits.
Alison,
and that's why I always come
chance.
Out the best. I'm kidding all the people off, all the other hosts. That's how it works.
Okay.
Anyway.
What's the song, Rob?
So the song is
I like the way. He was just introducing himself into it. He was making sure that he can't be cut out by, you know.
I've got a bit of a gender bending song here. She's called Yael Naeem. She's not gender bending herself. She's a French Israeli chanteuse. She's very good. Karen Ann. She's a French Israeli chanteuse.
You know I like her.
I know you like her. I thought I'd mention her.
Okay.
This is a track called Man of Another Woman, and it's from an album called She Was a Boy. You listen to that and figure it out while you're listening to this beautiful music. Yeah, it takes something like that to get Andrew Belly dancing. But I tell you what, we've done it.
But it was worth it just to see that.
Well, Sharpie's biscuits out with the belly, and then you get the music. That's good.
Precisely, exactly. So that's rather good, isn't it?
I absolutely love it. I always like that kind of, you know, that. It's interesting because she's obviously Israeli, but it's the same kind of sound you'd hear in Lebanon, or you know, it's like that Arabic kind
of. Yeah, it is. A Levantine lilt, you might call it.
That's good because then everyone will be happy because otherwise you'll be misnaming people and kind of causing border wars.
Musical
border wars.
Yeah, exactly. In other culture, has anyone seen the? Do you see the Olympic torch?
Yes, I have seen it.
I haven't seen it. No, I heard about it. It was sort of
Andrew's technically on holiday.
Didn't look very good. Well, exactly. That means that he's, you know, able to watch TV all the time rather than actually doing any work. So I must have been slaving away in the office.
I quite like it.
I thought it was rather good. I thought it was something to be proud of. Actually,
I did.
British design.
I did.
It looked a bit like a huge. One of the main reasons for me liking it looked like a huge brandy snap.
Didn't it? Yeah, it did look like
brandy. Did you? Cause that wasn't how it was described on the radio. Actually, it was
cheese grater. They said.
No, a poo. How they described it.
There's always like some miserable old kind of.
It was Radio 4.
Well, there's always some misery. Mm. But the one that they did have a kind of rundown of some of the ones from previous Olympics. And there was the Canadian one. And they nicknamed theirs the giant tote because it looked like a big reefer, because it was like a big white one. So it looked like someone was running because it was burning at the top, running through the streets with a massive joint. It was good.
That is good.
I liked ours.
Yeah, I know. That was Barbara and Oglesby.
Can I ask, did you get any Olympics tickets?
No, I didn't get any, actually. I didn't apply for any.
I haven't got any either.
Well, that would be why you didn't get any.
In our line of work, you just phone up someone, don't you? Tell them who you are. That's what I'm going to do.
I don't think that's going to work with the Olympics.
Anyway, that was the culture section. But coming up next, we've got Jane Morrison. So that's a bit more culture.
We like her.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a minute. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where we thought we'd take a look ahead to this week's Art Basel. Now in its 42nd year, the world's premier international art fair for modern and contemporary works features nearly 300 galleries showing the work of 2,500 artists. Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper, joins us now in the studio to tell us more about what we can expect from the show. Jane, thanks for coming in again. It's that time of the year again.
Certainly is. Art fairs.
When presumably you spend a lot of quality time with your suitcase.
Indeed. In fact, I think this time we all came off Venice, threw our stuff out into the washing machine and the dry cleaners, and it's now all been thrown back in to go to the next one in Basel.
And just to give people an idea, it started in Hong Kong 3 weeks ago, then it was the Venice Biennale last week, and next week is Art Basel. And a lot of the same faces, I suppose, are at all of these events.
Yeah.
And coming now third in this kind of conveyor belt, how does Basel refresh itself? Is it still the sort of, you know, art heartland?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think for modern and contemporary art, Basel is still the gold standard. As you probably know, some of your listeners will know, Basel has actually bought a 60% stake in the Hong Kong fair, which took place 3-4 weeks ago, and may well end up with 100% stake by 2014. So they've obviously got their eyes on developing Hong Kong in the same way that they've developed Miami. But at the moment, most collectors in Asia are still buying Asian art. So I think for the main international collecting world, Basel is still the place.
Yeah, we've heard so much about Hong Kong and China being the second biggest art market now in the world. from fresh from the pages of the art newspaper, that fact was gleaned, in fact.
It is a debatable fact, actually.
Okay. Fact with an asterisk on it. my favourite type of facts, in fact.
An assumption.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. But I wondered how, you know, whether Basel itself will be attracting Asian buyers, or whether there's a sense of sort of giving up on them because and buying the Hong Kong fair as such.
Well, as I say, I think Basel has always attracted some Asian buyers. I mean, there's been years when there's been significant groups coming from places like Korea. But it's a tricky one. As I say, mainland Chinese buyers are still really buying Chinese art. They're actually still buying mostly traditional Chinese art. And the contemporary art they're buying is mostly by artists who make traditional style art. So I think that with Hong Kong, the hope is that they will be attracting some of the buyers in the Southeast Asian region, and obviously people from Hong Kong itself and from, I say, Korea, Singapore, those kind of places. And they hope that they'll be in the right place when and if the Chinese make the transition to buying contemporary Western and modern Western art. I think people think that will happen, but it's by no means certain because China has such a long history of its own. And obviously, because of the Cultural Revolution and so forth, lots of people have not had access to the heritage, let alone the contemporary. So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, it seems it's a smart move, but I'm sure that they will still be regarding Basel very much as the home base.
And talking of which, do we expect to see the sort of solid middle European galleries at home in Basel? Is this a sort of an art fair that has a kind of rock-solid foundation in terms of the galleries that turn up there? You can always see the same galleries in the same place. Is that how it works?
Yeah. As the turnover at Basel in the main sections, which is modern downstairs and contemporary mostly upstairs, doesn't change very much from year to year. There will be a solid core of German galleries, Swiss galleries, the leading American galleries, the leading London galleries, who will always try to get their seat at that fair if they possibly can. And in fact, in fairness, a lot of those galleries are the ones that then go on to Miami and almost certainly will go on to Hong Kong. I imagine they will be offering people series discounts if they've got any sense. Yeah. And that's how they will be trying to tempt people over to Hong Kong. There's a lot of interest in Hong Kong, but there's also a fair degree of scepticism, I would say. So in terms of the business, I think that Basel have done, say, a smart move, and they will try and book people into all three fairs.
But people presumably need to look at they still need to fear the art might of the German-speaking world. Fries has just started publishing its magazine in German as well, and I presume, you know, Basel's reputation precedes it. I suppose its logo will be tagged onto the Hong Kong fair as well.
Yeah, I mean, Germany's always been an important centre for art. I mean, both in terms of producing artists, in terms of art schools, in terms of its great museums, in terms of its sort of cultural heritage. So I'm not sure that it needs to fear anything, but I think that Germany is one of the great centres, like New York, like Paris, like London. So you would expect to see a lot of those galleries. And of course, since the fall of the wall, Germany, as I'm sure you all know, Berlin particularly, has become the place to get a studio. There's a big art scene there. It's cheap. It's still cheapish. There's, good art schools, great museums.
Can I ask you, obviously it's a rivalrous world out there amongst these fairs. How do they kind of try and nudge? Do they try and move themselves ahead in the schedule to get in first? Do people actually run out of money, the buyers, as they go around these fairs? Is there a feeling that if you're the last fair of the season that people are probably a bit kind of cash poor by the time they get to you? They've spent their millions in Basel. How do they kind of jockey amongst themselves?
Well, that's quite a tricky one, actually. I mean, it's certainly the case that when Miami was set up, there were a number of sort of driving factors, and one of them was the fact that New Yorkers like going somewhere sunny in the winter, so December is a good idea. Miami is easy for them and relatively cheap. They don't have to cross time zones, and Miami then was relatively cheap in December. It's not now because all the hotels hiked up their prices, but initially it was cheap. And also they really wanted to attract the Latin American market, and they like Miami. And then I'd say there were other factors, like there were collectors there and whatever. But really, it's those two factors. So I think when they're looking at developing fairs, they're going to look at what will bring the existing market, the existing collectors. So you want something that's attractive and interesting and going to appeal to collectors, which I don't think is necessarily just about timing. It's about where it is. It's about what the programme is like. You know, is it somewhere that people think is going to be fun, interesting to go to? And then they're going to look to see if it also brings in a new market as well. But as you know, Art Basel and the Hong Kong Fair organisers have run into some problems with Hong Kong because they wanted to move it to February to keep it as far away as possible from the Basel Fair. And unfortunately, that's clashed with Chinese New Year and the Chinese aren't too impressed by this. So now it's had to move back to May. And May means it's very close to Basel again. So that's not ideal.
But meanwhile, we hear rumours of people wanting to pile into the New York market. And I think Rob was telling me earlier on about this as well.
Yeah, New York's an interesting one. New York has never really had a standout art fair. Well, there's lots of reasons for that. In one sense, it's because the gallery scene there is so big and so strong that New York galleries have never felt any real reason to have a fair and really back it 100%. So at the moment, the fairs that they've got, which is the sort of big, sprawling, messy armoury, and the very niche ADAA, which is like an association of art dealers, aren't sort of world-beating fairs. So Frieze has decided to attempt to sort of crack this market by opening this new fair in May also. So again, the confluence of Hong Kong and the new Frieze in New York is going to be a tricky one. I think several dealers are going to find themselves with divided loyalties on that one. So yeah, so Frieze is going to give it a go.
Let alone Rob's travel schedule. What's that going to be like, Rob?
I'll be doing most of this by satellite link up next year.
Okay,
it's fine. As will Jane, I just imagine. And you mentioned the sort of serendipity of Miami being there for the Latin American collectors, and New York is flying down to somewhere warm in December. Is it really as simple as that? I mean, we talk about Basel. I think people, maybe a lot of the people I've spoken to in the last few weeks, look forward to Basel less clearly than going to Miami or going to Hong Kong somewhere new and mixing it up. Do you think Basel suffers from that, or is it always, because it is the sort of serious epicenter of the art market, it always succeeds?
Well, it's a hard one to call. We've noticed this year there's almost no parties at Basel this year. There were absolutely hundreds at Venice. Some collectors are saying that's great. They didn't like the froth. They don't like the flim flam. They don't like Miami very much. You know, they don't like that kind of thing. And I think a lot of the serious middle Europeans that you talked about, and the big industrialists and some of the old money, would actually deeply prefer a quieter, more serious Basel, as it very much used to be. On the other hand, a lot of the sort of fun and games and the media and the parties, attracts new collectors, it attracts film stars, it attracts people with cash. So I think we'll have to sort of play this one by ear. My own feeling is that Basel is still probably safe for some time to come.
Your editors at large will have to work a bit harder for the showbiz
I think our diary column is going to be challenging.
I wanted to ask you a bit about what your days will be like when you're in Basel. I mean, is it, do you book up, meetings back to back, or do you get a sense, do you sort of have a bit of freedom to go around? I understand you do a daily newspaper as well.
Yeah.
I mean, how long are your hours when you're there?
The fairs are pretty hard. We take a team of about 20, which is a mixture of reporters, designers, photographers, sub-editors, the lot. We set up in a room in the Ramada Tower. We basically take our office there, and we start each day around 9 in the morning, I suppose, which doesn't sound too bad until you hear that we finish at 2 a.m. the following morning and get up again for 9 again for 4 days on the trot. So it's quite hard work, but it's also quite good fun. I mean, people have got used to us being there. It was very hard when we first started, but now people, they're quite keen to give us tips and gossip and leads to stories. And obviously we root out quite a lot ourselves completely independently. So it's a bit of a challenge for us, but it makes a difference from sitting in our office in sunny Vauxhall. We have a New York office too. We have a New York office and they're in Broadway, lucky them, but I'm afraid the rest of us are sitting in Vauxhall. So
and the daily paper, just to finish, actually, the daily paper has a bit of a different vibe to it than the monthly newspaper, doesn't it? It is a bit more about who bought what and who was doing what and all the rest of it.
It's definitely markety and it's definitely gossipy, whereas I think we have actually got a conservation article, I think, planned for this one, but you're not really going to get a 3-page conservation article or museum analysis.
Well, Jane, I hope your dry cleaning gets back to your suitcase in time for the next flight out to Basel. Jane Boris, editor of the Art Newspaper, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time for some parting words, it says on the script.
Well, let's do them.
Let's do the outro chat, because that's also what it says. What do you think?
It's very technical.
Now that the king's wearing his beige shorts with sailboat motif. Long live the king. What do you think of the show?
Well, I'm annoyed to say you've done very well. Very well.
It was a bit testy to begin with, wasn't it?
Yeah, a bit testy to begin with, but I'm proud of you. It's proud of you. It's worked out very well.
We had some nice guests, and we had Jane Morris on. She's nice to interview, isn't she?
Yeah, and we were there when you kind of fainted a couple of times. We got you back on your chair.
Yeah.
And I particularly like the culture section where you interviewed yourself.
Yeah.
It was good. I had a cup of tea during that bit.
This is the future of radio, Steve. This is how it's going to work.
What? Robert Bound talking to himself on an endless loop. It sounds like the end of a book.
RB24. It sounds like a J.G. Ballard nightmare, doesn't it?
I'm looking forward to getting the rest of the countdown on the next show.
Yes, I can't wait to see what is 10 to 1.
10 to 1. That sounds like we were taking a bet, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What's going to be 10 to 1? I'll give you 10 to 1.
So we had 25 down to 11 today. That was narrated by Tom Morris and Jonathan Openshaw, aided and abetted by a jazz flute in the background. Do you think there might be a different instrument to count down from 11 to 1? What do you think that might be a massive drum roll?
I do know that we spent a lot of money buying the flute. So I've got a feeling the flute might be back next week.
Maybe we blew it last week. We'll suck it for the last 10.
Something like that, Rob. Yes,
something so to speak.
Okay.
Our producer Chris Sharp is a musician in the evenings, and he's an electronic musician. He's told me about his collection of vintage Moog synthesizers. Maybe he can knock something up. Who knows?
Really?
Yeah.
At home with his Moog.
Yeah, at home with his Moog and his cocktail shaker.
Well, I wonder if maybe he has a Moggy and a Moog, because we did find something on the floor of the studio today that looks a bit like a cat's claw.
God, or a dog's claw. Okay.
We can't go into that. It's international radio.
Okay.
Tune in next Thursday, I believe, when we're going to be doing a special show announcing the winner of our Most Livable City 2011. And that's all for edition 103 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, please drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our website. But for now, from London, I'm Robert Bound.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Steve Bloomfield.
Cheerio.